Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on this second Super Tuesday, or the mini Super Tuesday, whatever. We're joined by E.J. Dionne, who's a Washington Post columnist, Georgetown professor. He's at Brookings, contributed to NPR, MSNBC, and the author of a new book called Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. So, good morning. How are you, E.J.?
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on this great day for democracy.
Well, we'll see how great it is. But so you're talking about progressives and moderates uniting to save our country. So this fight between progressives and moderates in the Democratic Party is being litigated even as we speak today. We're going to find out which direction the Democratic Party goes and whether or not they're going to ever be able to get their act together, aren't we?
Right. And I think you're actually beginning to see a movement toward the getting their act together poll. The first two sentences of my book are, will progressives and moderates feud while America burns, or will these natural allies take advantage of a historic opportunity to strengthen American democracy and defeat an increasingly radical form of conservatism, which, by the way, you wrote about in your book some time ago. And what I see happening are two things out there. One is the quick movement to Joe Biden within literally 3 days on the first Super Tuesday really indicated how hungry Democrats are to defeat Donald Trump. One of the things I argue in the book is that this debate over whether we need restoration or transformation is actually a false choice. Obviously, we need to restore norms that Trump has just busted through. We need to restore the rule of law. We need to restore leadership whose purpose is not to divide the country. At the same time, Trump's rise suggested there are fundamental problems in the country that we need to deal with, that we do need transformative leadership. One of them, which is brought home by today's primaries, is the rise of a really, really stark regional inequalities in the country, not only between red states and blue states, but within states themselves and within metropolitan areas. We've got to grapple with that. The problems of our failure to resolve the immigration issue, the need for immigration reform that President Bush, George W. Bush, couldn't get through Congress because of opposition within his own party. In my book, I trace the beginning of Trumpism to that moment when a certain senator named Jeff Sessions rallied Republicans to kill immigration reform. And the economic inequality that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have talked about is really a problem that every part of the Democratic Party, and indeed to some degree now even Republicans like Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley, are starting to talk about. And so I think that this need for both restoration and transformation is something that could bring the whole big anti-Trump movement together. And I wrote the book because I think it's very urgent that they do come together.
Well, you have a sort of a sense of alarm whether or not Democrats learned their lesson from 2016, that if we have moderates and progressives don't work together, things will go wrong. So, well, before we get to the big picture, let's just take a moment to think about how the world, by which I mean the political world, has changed in the last 7 days. So a week ago Tuesday, think of all the things that have happened. And you mentioned this movement in 3 days. So tell me what your sense is. What happened in the Democratic Party? Because there was a moment when it looked like Bernie Sanders was on track. You had a lot of Democrats that were somewhat nervous about the prospect of having a Democratic socialist at the top of the ticket. Joe Biden was widely regarded as a dead man walking, and everything has turned around. And it seems that not only the voters, but the Democratic establishment has just decided that it's going to go with the center lane. So just tell me, was it panic? Was it consensus? Was it sort of a meeting of the minds? What happened over the last 7 days?
See, I think that what happened was both astonishing and not surprising. Mm. The astonishing part is, as you said, that Joe Biden, as he loves to say now in speeches, was left for dead, that he made this comeback and won all these primaries with no ground game, that famous word, words everybody likes to talk about that seem to make no difference, with virtually no advertising in any of these states. Here was Mike Bloomberg spending $500 million and, you know, Joe Biden with almost nothing. All of that is quite astonishing. The reason I think it's not as surprising as we make it is because Democrats from the beginning, from Iowa forward, were sending signals that they were desperately looking for a nominee more or less middle of the road mm-hmm. who could pull the party together against Trump. In Iowa, because he did so much good work there and because he really captured people's imagination, Pete Buttigieg was the recipient of that vote. In New Hampshire, you saw the same kind of movement toward Amy Klobuchar just in the last few days before the New Hampshire primary, which, by the way, probably deprived Pete Buttigieg of a chance to beat Bernie Sanders there. And I was speaking to Biden people the weekend before Super Tuesday, where they rightly pointed to the rapid movement toward Klobuchar after her good debate performance as a sign of things that could come Joe Biden's way once he won that overwhelming victory down in South Carolina. And I think that sort of sent light bulbs going off in the majority of Democrats who told exit pollsters again and again that their priority was beating Trump, not finding a candidate who agreed with them on issues. In exit poll after exit poll, it was 60 to 65% of Democrats said beating Trump is the priority. And what first Nevada, we shouldn't underrate what happened in Nevada because it was the first primary where you didn't have a virtually all white, a 90 plus percent white electorate. And while it was a weak second place, Joe Biden managed to get himself into second place. It showed where both Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar were running short. And then came South Carolina, where African-Americans who are in, as many have said, and I think rightly so, the most pragmatic part of the Democratic electorate, pushed along by Jim Clyburn's endorsement, which clearly made a difference, gave Biden this overwhelming victory. And at that moment, all the Democrats looking for the candidate who could defeat Trump said, OK, that's it. Joe Biden's the guy. And we are all going there. And they did all over the country. There were polls in California that showed Joe Biden in single digits. And he managed very quickly to get himself not only over the 15% threshold, but way over. And then in state after state, Massachusetts probably being one of the most dramatic, home of Elizabeth Warren, along came Joe Biden and he won that primary. But I think the hunger to beat Trump is the dominating sentiment in the Democratic Party, and that's why Joe Biden is now the front runner.
Now, I know that you've sworn off prognostication, as we all should have done, but it's sort of like crack. We keep coming back to it. So at the moment, while we're sitting here, it does look like the Democratic Party has settled on its nomination, that that Bernie Sanders has a very slim, perhaps no clear path to the nomination anymore. If he loses by double digits in Michigan, it seems like his campaign is really effectively over. And again, I'm not trying to get too far ahead of ourselves. I guess the question is, you know, and this is the theme of your book, will the Bernie bros make their peace with Biden? There's, you know, you look online, and I understand that Twitter is not real life. We have to remind ourselves that repeatedly. But, you know, they're still hammering Joe Biden. You have a lot of the Bernie bros who are putting out these hashtags about, you know, Joe Biden's cognitive decline. Bernie Sanders is continuing to talk about the corporate billionaires who are, you know, conspiring against him. So, what do you see happening between now and the Milwaukee convention? Will the progressives who are still so passionately behind Bernie Sanders, will they be able to make their peace with the fact that Joe Biden's going to be the nominee?
First of all, I hate to raise this, but you wonder with the coronavirus, what will happen to the party conventions this year? It's something that's been on a lot of people's minds. Will we see something completely different come the summertime? Hopefully we will.
Well, of course, I'm in Milwaukee, so that's an urgent question. It's interesting because for the first time in the last 48 hours, I've just noticed people wondering, are you actually going to have a convention here in Milwaukee?
Right.
Because I don't know about you, but every single thing that I've been scheduled to do over the next 2 months has been canceled. It is amazing.
Yeah, I love Wisconsin, so I hope for the sake of your economy out there, you don't lose all these folks coming in. First of all, as we talked about before the show began, I resigned from the Prognosticators Union about midnight on election night, although I always point out Hillary Clinton still did win the popular vote. And the national polls were right. They just made a few small errors in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Move on.
But I've quit the Prognosticators Union. But I think just looking at what is likely to happen in Michigan tonight without actually predicting analytically, I thought the most interesting state on Super Tuesday in some ways was Oklahoma. The reason I say that is because Oklahoma had voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 and it shifted to Biden. I think this is a reminder that a lot of the vote for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primaries was not an ideological vote. It was not a vote for democratic socialism. These were votes against Hillary Clinton.
Interesting.
And I, personally like Hillary Clinton and respect her a great deal, but a lot of voters didn't like her. And I think that when we see that a lot of the Bernie vote was anti-Clinton, it was a foreshadowing of what was going to happen to her in the fall. So tonight, one of the things I'm going to be looking for is how many of the Bernie counties, particularly in rural and small town Michigan or Missouri or elsewhere, how many of them just shift over to Joe Biden tonight? And I think that's the problem that Bernie faces, is that for whatever reason, some of them sexism, some of them that Joe Biden is the guy next door whom you like, he has not aroused the same kind of opposition that Hillary has. Now, the question going forward is which voice of the Sanders movement will be loudest? And a lot of that is up to Bernie Sanders himself. I was out in Iowa during the primaries, and I spoke to a lovely woman who was Bernie's coordinator in Iowa, the Iowa City area. And she said, why do people judge us by our loudest supporters? Why don't they judge us by our kindest supporters? And this person was speaking very positively about Elizabeth Warren when the Bernie bros were out there bashing Elizabeth Warren. The question is, how big a part of the Sanders movement are those voices? And does Bernie Sanders, as Elizabeth Warren suggested he should in her conversation with Rachel Maddow recently, how much does he call him back and say, look, the priority here is to beat Donald Trump? I think over the next 2 weeks, because there are also primaries the week week from now where it's looking like Sanders will lose, unless the polls are wildly wrong, Sanders will really get clobbered down in Florida, which he lost the last time.
And Georgia.
What does he do after that? And I think, the way I see it is Sanders would be better off for himself, and obviously it goes with the theme of my book about unity against Trump, to accept the fact that he's built a real movement inside the Democratic Party, not unlike the movement that the unions did back in the 1930s and 1940s, not unlike, in a way, the Christian right in the Republican Party. And I don't mean to compare the content of these two movements at all, but structurally, he's got something very important inside the Democratic Party, and he can decide to fight for his ideas to push Joe Biden in a more progressive direction, but to do so in a way that brings people together rather than pushes them apart. And I think a lot of that will be up to Bernie Sanders.
You make the point, how do you judge the movement? So Bernie Sanders could take that position, but will his followers go along with it? I'm looking at a lot of the commentary, and the thing about political cults is they can create their own reality, and they can substitute purity tests for the kind of pragmatism that you're talking about. If he was to say, hey, look, I don't have a path to the nomination, I need to suspend my campaign, a lot of his supporters are going to think he was stabbed in the back. So I guess that's the question, because I don't get the sense that they're in a mood for this thing to be over quite yet. I think the vast majority of Democrats want it to be over, but I'm just not sure. So I guess the question is, will his cult let him be rational, or will they force him to continue a sort of zombie campaign? And again, like he did 4 years ago, and whether he's going to continue to hammer Joe Biden. I mean, I think that's one of the big questions, and it goes to your book, whether you're going to feud or unite against Trump. Is that after tonight, including at the scheduled debate on Sunday, will he continue to attack Joe Biden when it becomes apparent that it's going to be Biden versus Trump?
Couple of things. One is, even in 2016, when there was some defection among Bernie voters, Hillary Clinton still got 80% of their votes. And as I suggested earlier, we know some of the Bernie votes were not the people who were movement Bernie people. They were just anti-Clinton Bernie people, which I think are very different. Secondly, I go back to my friend in Iowa. I think there are plenty of Bernie supporters who are not in it, to pick up on your term, who are not cult-like and who understand the importance of beating Trump. I think one way for Bernie to go forward, but in a less divisive way, is to say, you know, Joe Biden is a likely nominee. I'm going to support him. We're here standing for some principles that we want Democrats to take seriously. Join me in standing for those principles. But the other point, which is central to Code Red, is why did the Sanders movement arise in the first place? And I think the Sanders movement arose because a lot of Democrats, not just, you know, very far left Democrats, a lot of just regular progressive Democrats were very frustrated that for three decades, really, the public conversation was dominated by the Reagan economic consensus, and that an awful lot of Democrats spent their time not sort of laying out where they wanted to move the country, but kind of making their peace with the Reagan consensus, doing more negotiating with themselves to try to sound moderate than they did laying out an alternative vision. I think Bernie can look back on what he's done and say he has helped push the whole Democratic Party, including Joe Biden, including Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar, in a more progressive direction. One way to look at single-payer health care is not as the thing that will happen next. It is as a bargaining position that reminds people that Obamacare isn't socialism. Single-payer health care is the left wing of this conversation. Only in Los Angeles and San Francisco do people begin bargaining on a house with the asking price. I think Bernie has laid out a series of positions that give more moderate progressives a lot more room to say, we are for a public option. We think that taxing wealth should be part of the conversation, even if we don't want to do it the way Elizabeth Warren did. We need to vastly expand access to higher ed and post-secondary training for people not college-bound, whether you're for free college or not. I think Bernie could look back, if he wished, with a lot of satisfaction out of how he has transformed the debate. And in Code Red, I argue that that's the way to look at it. At the same time, I am hoping that people on the left recognize that a lot of fundamental change in our country happens in a gradual way. I quote a great American Democratic Socialist Mike Harrington referring to the idea of visionary gradualism. Now, I know not a single person out there is going to march behind a banner that says visionary gradualism, But that is the right way change is often made in our country. Social Security was not what it became. It was a narrower program, but it created something we could build on. I think Obamacare has done the same thing in the healthcare area, where it gave us something to build on. And so I hope that notion that the left is right, we need a vision. The center is right, that change often happens gradually. Let's bring these two insights together in a real movement.
This is a very interesting point, because I wanted to ask you about this, because you're talking about how progressives and moderates can unite to save our country. But the quote-unquote moderates that we've seen running for president are actually, by any historic standard, really quite progressive. They're really quite liberal. I mean, that whole Overton window has been moved. In many ways, Pete Buttigieg was running to the left of Barack Obama, but he seemed moderate in comparison to, say, Bernie Sanders, and maybe moderate in terms of his temperament and the kind of maybe gradualist approach that you're talking about. But really, you know, how do you define what a moderate is anymore, particularly from a conservative point of view? Because there are people, Republicans, who say there are no moderates in the Democratic Party. They're all liberals.
Well, I think temperament actually matters, and I think that Trump has reminded us how important temperament is. And temperament is actually what brings together people who are quite progressive these days with, if I may say so to a Bulwark audience, the conservatives who have turned on Trump, the anti-Trump conservatives, who loom much larger in the world of in the intellectual world, in the world of commentary, than in the party itself. I quote in the book a political scientist out at Indiana called Aurelien Creutzwaelder, who wrote an interesting book called Faces of Moderation. And he talks about moderation as something that promotes social and political pluralism. It has a propensity to seek conciliation and find balance between various ideas, interests, and groups. It does not assume there's only a single correct or valid way of life on which we all might agree. I think this kind of pluralism that he is talking about is what unites the entire movement that has risen up against Trump, including some of our conservative friends, or if I may use the word, comrades. And I think that moderation as a virtue is very important. But from my point of view as a progressive, I think progressive reform, in order to narrow some of the economic inequalities that have grown in our country, to deal with the fact that the big crash of 2008 moved the whole country to the left in certain ways, because free market capitalism does not look the same to people. And I'm not talking just about lefties. I'm talking about average Americans. I'm even talking about people like Marco Rubio. It just doesn't look the same to people as it did before 2008. And that's what I think it is possible to bring temperamental values of moderation together with a progressivism that tries to build a broad majority in the country.
In so many ways, the Trumpian movement has been a rejection of that sort of temperament of moderation, leaving aside the specifics. So here's another question I wanted to ask you, and I wanted to ask you about, because, as you know, I was a reader of How the Right Lost It. I mean, so it's my book, How the Right Lost Is Mine. You wrote the book before that, How the Right Went Wrong. And one of the points that you made that really stuck with me about how the conservative movement went wrong is they became addicted to making promises that they could not keep, that were impossible to keep, and then when they failed, ginned up the outrage machines. Is that correct? Is that a fair statement of one of your points?
Yeah, that is one important theme of the book. Go on.
So now my question is, I'm listening to a lot of the progressives running for president making, dramatic promises, free this, free that, transformation, $60 trillion. They're making promises they can't keep, that are literally impossible to keep. And I wonder whether or not there's a risk that you will have a similar kind of derangement or disillusionment / outrage on the left if the Democrats get back into office and people begin to realize, well, you're not doing any of the things that you promised. You ran on all of this stuff, but it turns out that they're really the progressive equivalent of, I will build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. No, you're not getting all the free stuff.
I don't Obviously, and this may reflect a difference in point of view, I don't see the core promises being made in this campaign as unkeepable. Now, obviously, if the Republicans hold the Senate, it's going to be very hard to pass anything, even if the Democrats do take the House, which, by the way, is another reason why I think Biden really had this sweep. Because a lot of Democrats are focusing on down ballot races, how to keep the House, how to win the Senate. And they are looking at the districts and the states that Democrats need to win in order to have majorities in both houses. And they realize that having a more moderate candidate like Biden would give them a better chance to do that. You know, in the book, I argue that single payer health care is very unlikely to be achieved anytime soon. And that indeed, there are many countries that guarantee coverage to everyone, decent, affordable coverage with mixed systems, and that building on Obamacare is a very keepable promise if you have Democratic majorities. Getting everyone health insurance, Obamacare has gotten us to roughly 90% of Americans covered, somewhere within the range of 90%. We got to finish that job. That's very doable. Free college tomorrow morning probably can't happen, although we forget that that is not as radical as it sounds. When John F. Kennedy was president, for example, going to the University of California was essentially free. There was a very modest charge for, a registration charge, and that was it. So we really have lost a lot of ground in terms of access to higher ed after the Great Recession, when state after state cut spending on higher education. So making progress on that front is not impossible. And it's certainly, it better not be impossible to make progress on climate change. So I don't see these promises as outlandish, as long as people accept my sort of formula for visionary gradualism. A step today can lead to a step forward tomorrow. And I think the question is, do you put the country on a different track than it is now? And then you start moving down that track at a speed that the political system can accommodate.
I think you made a point a few minutes ago that I think is insufficiently appreciated, which is the way that our politics has really broken what I suppose you could describe as conservative orthodoxy, the way the Republican Party is united about one thing right now, which is loyalty to Donald Trump, the cult of personality. But as long as you're loyal to Donald Trump, you apparently have a green light to rethink free market economics, priorities, whether or not you're in favor of stimulus packages, infrastructure packages, et cetera. And you are seeing this among some of the senators. I'm not a fan any longer of Marco Rubio, and certainly not of Josh Hawley. But as you point out, we're never going to go back to Reagan type conservatism. I mean, that seems to, whether it's been intellectually refuted or not, there's clearly no political constituency. So there is a post Trump sort of a possibility. I think that's what you're talking about, where you can, in a pragmatic way, move public policy in ways that might have been inconceivable earlier. Or is that too optimistic?
Right. No, I have the same hope. If I could, 2 points from the book. Point one is that you can tell which side of a given debate is winning when the opposition starts accommodating itself to that winning side. And I argue that back in the 80s, the appearance of what were then called the Atari Democrats really was the Democratic Party accommodating itself to Reaganite market economics. I think you are now seeing the end of Reaganism as people on the right accommodate themselves to a view that the free market does need regulation. It does need some redistribution. That's why I mentioned Hawley and Marco Rubio. It's what the Niskanen Institute, one of the most interesting new think tanks, is doing. These are former libertarians who say, wait a minute, social democratic countries actually have better distribution and pretty strong forms of capitalism, maybe we should look toward social democratic capitalism. And so I think that is what you are seeing now. And Trump obviously didn't feel bound by Reaganism and sort of began to break some of that China in the primaries. The other point is I really want a different Republican Party inspired by a different kind of conservatism. The second chapter of my book is called Missing in Action, and I lay out, and I'd be very curious what your listeners would make of this chapter. I talk about, let's imagine a different Republican Party inspired by a different kind of conservatism. And, you know, I think conservatism's sort of contribution to the public debate is that it is skeptical of sweeping plans to transform society that we progressives come up with because conservatives want to preserve what's best in the existing society. But real Burkean conservatives always recognize the need for reform. You can't preserve a tradition if you don't adjust it to new realities, and you can't preserve our constitutional system unless you recognize that this is a very different country in 2020 than it was in 1787 or 1860 or 1865. And I would like to see, that's why I was happy to appear on your podcast, because I want some conservatives to come over to our side, but I also want some conservatives to rethink what it means to be a conservative.
No, and this is a very interesting chapter. You know, this reimagined GOP would still be broadly pro-business. It would extol freedom, entrepreneurship, inventiveness. It would stress the important role of non-governmental institutions, community groups, churches, families. It would be skeptical of sweeping plans. It would not launch attacks on the FBI or the CIA. It would keep taxes low, but not so low as to make it impossible to finance needed government initiatives. And it would be open to reform, recognizing that the old dogmas are not sufficient. That certainly is possible. So you outline three kinds of politics: politics of remedy, a politics of dignity, and a politics of more. Can we walk through them?
Yeah, thank you for that.
Okay, politics of remedy.
I go way back to a great Arthur Schlesinger Jr. quote that democratic politics, small d, always ought to be about remedy. Every society confronts particular problems. Sometimes they're huge, and sometimes they are not so huge. But if politics is working, it allows people to have debates, serious debates, over how you solve particular problems. I think solutionism is underrated as an ideology. And so I want our politics to be about arguing about how to fix problems, not arguing either over abstractions or over issues that are invented purely to divide people. A politics of dignity. Dignity is a very important idea in the book. During the 2018 elections, I did some traveling around the country, and one of the people I visited with was Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, the Democrat, who gave a great speeches on, and very carefully thought through speeches on what he called the dignity of work. And I think dignity is a concept that can actually pull us together, because a felt denial of dignity is certainly how African Americans and is what African Americans and immigrants and refugees are experiencing in the Trump era. But I think a felt denial of dignity is also what people in places like Youngstown, Ohio, or Erie, Pennsylvania, or Reading, Pennsylvania, basically people who are white working class and African-American and Latino, and that our economy ought to be about helping people have a dignified life, which means, and here I'm channeling Gene Sperling, the former Clinton and Obama economic advisor, who has a good book coming out on this later this year, can lead a dignified family life, get respect at work, and can advance themselves in their lives. And a politics of more is that those of us who are progressive, whether we want to do it with single payer or with a public option, want more Americans to have access to health insurance, more to have access to college or post-secondary training, And I would add more to feel much safer in their communities because of more sensible regulation of guns. And so I think a politics of remedy, dignity, and a politics of more actually can be a sort of launching ground for a new approach after the Trump era.
One of the things that one of the critiques I've heard of the Democratic candidates, though, has been that with the possible exception maybe of Joe Biden, they didn't talk a lot about economic growth. There was a lot of talk about redistribution, a lot of talk about new government programs, but not a lot of focus on actually growing the pie. So in your vision of the future, does the Democratic Party go back to being the party of more economic growth, or is it going to be the, hey, we'd have to learn to live with limits and just carve up what we have now?
No, I think that what we have to understand more clearly than we did in the Reagan era is that there are paths to growth based on trickle-down economics that basically asserts the only way to grow is to let those job creators, basically capital, reap a lot of benefits and they'll invest and that'll produce jobs. That is a path to growth, but it's a path to very unequal growth. For a long period, from the post-New Deal period through the 1970s, we had extraordinary growth in our country that was far more egalitarian. It was much more, instead of trickle-down, it was bottom-up growth. We invested with the GI Bill in a whole generation of Americans who helped create the great American middle class. We accepted with Keynesian economics that putting purchasing power in the hands of large numbers of people actually helps the economy to grow. It was kind of funny to look at Trump saying, well, his solution is to cut the payroll tax. Jeez. Well, at least there is one insight behind that, which is it's good to put purchasing power in the hands of average Americans. So I am for a more egalitarian path to economic growth. And I think history suggests that a more egalitarian path, not absolute equality, no society ever achieves that, but a fairer society can produce fairer and more sustainable levels of economic growth. And that's what I am for.
It's unclear to me what the pro-business philosophy of Republicans is right now. I suppose we'd call them Foxconn conservatives, where after railing against the government picking the winners and losers, now we have this sort of corporatist mentality where state and local governments and even the federal government will single out specific industries for lavish taxpayer support. It strikes me that there would be some common ground between populists on the left and libertarians on the right saying this is just ridiculous, this massive transfer of wealth to these very profitable corporations and the crony capitalism of handing out public goods to private entities. I mean, that's one of the things that I think should discuss people on both ends of the political spectrum.
Right. I think it was, again, to go back to Mike Harrington, I think he talked about an economy that socializes the losses for everyone else and subsidizes the gains of the very rich. I think, we've had this debate now for 40 years. There was a writer back in, I think, 1980, who wrote a book called The Last Entrepreneurs, who said the real risk takers in our society are the people who run government economic development agencies that take on the risks that capitalists are supposed to take on with all of these subsidies. I think there is a real national conversation to be had on where certain kinds of subsidies, whether they are for job training for people, or for building up infrastructure, which is a general benefit. There are ways in which government can foster economic growth and be helpful to capitalist economic growth that are not narrow subsidies to handpicked people who get a benefit from government that everybody else doesn't. There's a reason why we are talking more about kleptocracy in the world, a class of very rich people whose wealth depends on favor from government. So I do think there is a conversation to be had among libertarians and progressives on these grounds. But I think there are still ways in which there may be certain industries that we do want to help grow, one of them being industries that would help us move off fossil fuels. That's an area where I would not be a pure libertarian. I would say if we can make sustainable, or if we can make non-carbon producing energy efficient over time, it may be worth some initial investments.
What is the biggest mistake you think that the left makes in talking to the American public? I've written a whole book about where the right has gone wrong. In terms of where progressives are not connecting with the electorate, what advice would you give them? I have something in mind in case you want.
We can't end the show without my hearing what you have in mind. A few things, that some of which I talk about in Code Red, which my publisher would note. I haven't mentioned enough in the conversation because you got me so engaged. I grew up in a factory town in Massachusetts called Fall River. It's very important. My hometown is very important to me. It's an old mill town that has been on the wrong side of the economy for a long time. It's a predominantly Catholic town. It was a very, very union town. It was a strong union town back in the day. For my whole life, really, I have worried about how a certain kind of progressive or upper middle class liberal thinks about white working class people, because those were my folks growing up. I think that at times liberals give off, for example, a hostility to religion that I think is a mistake. It's one of the reasons I love the way Pete Buttigieg spoke about religion. There are an awful lot of religious people who are intelligent, rational, community-building people who care deeply about the poor, as the scripture says they should. And so I've been arguing for a very different approach than liberals sometimes take in talking about religion. Obama was actually quite good at it when he did it, particularly in this great speech he gave to the Call to Renewal conference back in 2006 that I think everybody should reread. So that is one area. The second area is, I think that we should approach the Trump electorate in a complicated, not a simple-minded way. I think my progressive friends are right to say it's a form of denial if we try to pretend that race, racism, anti-immigrant feeling had nothing to do with why people voted for Trump. There was a real constituency for Trump's anger, and if I may call it that, for his racism. However, not every Trump voter was voting on those issues. There were a lot of Trump voters who either didn't like Hillary Clinton or who were angry about the position they were in. All of the studies of the Trump vote show that that he did best, not necessarily in the most economically troubled areas, but the highest unemployment areas, but places that had seen real economic decline. Trump carried 2,500 counties. Clinton carried 450, but 64% of the GDP was in those 450 Hillary Clinton counties. That tells us something. And we should remember that in 2018, 10 to 15% of Trump voters flipped to the Democrats when given different alternatives. So in the book, in a way, my core message is from an old quotation from the great political commentator Mark Shields. He said that political movements like religious movements can either be heretic hunters or convert seekers. And the whole point of Code Red is to ask all progressives and all moderates who want to replace Trump to put aside heretic hunting and embrace the job of seeking converts.
Oh, that is excellent. No, you made two great points there. And I think that this is where you sort of have the parallel problem. I think that Republicans and conservatives really need to engage in a lot of introspection on the race issue. What we missed, what we were willing to tolerate, perhaps becoming a little bit numbed to real concerns. And so I think that that's a job that we have to undertake. But on the other hand, I think it's so important. I've been on so many panels where there's sort of just this glib dismissal of everyone who disagrees with them as simply as racist. And, you know, part of the problem is if you label an entire group of voters as racist, they're gonna stop listening to you. They're going to turn you off. They're going to roll their eyes. And you're not going to convert them. I also think that there is that disdain for religion and an insensitivity that played a much bigger role in 2016 than I think than most people have fully realized. And a little bit of sensitivity, a little bit of respect goes a long way. You mentioned Barack Obama. I remember Jimmy Carter. Even Bill Clinton was able to use the language of faith in a respectful way. But I guess I was thinking when I first asked the question about things that they get wrong, I was thinking about that former Elizabeth Warren aide who said, we just have to stop talking about pronouns. We have to stop having a debate about pronouns. I mean, once you start debating pronouns, what is the wokest pronoun, you basically have made yourself irrelevant to so many voters. So, yeah, let's talk about the economy. Let's talk about growth. Let's talk about dignity. But maybe we could put the debate about the proper use of pronouns off to a kinder and gentler time. That was my point.
So, in other words, I think one of the great areas of progress in the last 20 years has been in our attitudes toward LGBTQ people. And what's really striking about that is that attitudes toward LGBTQ people are overwhelmingly positive, except among the oldest Americans. And even they are changing their view as they discover that a son or a brother or a cousin or a dear friend or a coworker are gay or lesbian. So I think we should do everything we can to end that form of prejudice. And by the way, this notion that we can talk to white working people, first of all, as a lot of progressives have pointed out, an awful lot of working class Americans are not white. They are Latino or African American. And we need to talk about the entire working class of every color who face particular challenges. And on this idea of dignity, I think one of my political heroes, I quote him at the beginning of the book, is Robert Kennedy. And one of the reasons Robert Kennedy moved so many people was his capacity to build trust across the lines of race, that white working class people trusted him to understand the problems they faced, and African Americans trusted him to understand the injustices that they faced. And we need a revival of that kind of politics. And the other point I make in the book is to remember that the Great Civil Rights March of 1963, where Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech, it was the March on Washington for jobs and justice. It's this united economic justice with racial justice. It argued that you can't exercise the rights that we all should be granted if you don't have the economic wherewithal to exercise them. And so that's a kind of politics that we need in a new key for 2020. We can't go back to 1968. In many ways, we don't want to go back to the great tragedies of 1968. But we need to pick up on that fight and move it forward into the next decade.
Yeah, I don't want to leave people with the wrong impression about my feelings about the LGBT, I'm sounding like Joe Biden now, community. I do think that we need to have respect as opposed to the gotcha culture. And yes, I don't think I've seen any social transformation quite as dramatic as the acceptance of gay Americans, but I think that there's a line between the cancel culture and good manners and acceptance and tolerance, I think part of that is somewhat nuance, that sense that if I cross some invisible tripwire that I'm going to be erased, as opposed to, let's have collegial correction. One of the interesting things that we talk about the African-American vote, the pragmatism, the willingness to say we're not going to demand absolute purity or absolute identity politics because we are willing to make coalitions. This struck me as really a sign of the maturity of the African-American electorate in a way that I don't think had been fully appreciated before this year. And really quite striking.
Well, all along, an awful lot of African-American commentators have made the point that the African-American community is very pragmatic.
Yeah.
Number one, because they see more clearly than anyone the dangers of four more years of Donald Trump. Secondly, historically, it has really mattered to African-Americans who is in power, because government power has been used both to oppress them in the days of segregation and going back to when the laws in the South validated slavery, or as a form of liberation through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and later through the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. So African Americans, I think, have a keener sense than anyone that it really, really matters who is in the legislature, who is governor, who runs, who is in the White House. And they also, I think, have a sense of the, of, if you will, of original sin and the failure of other human beings, including white Americans. So they are very sensitive to who can we find, who can be a candidate that enough white Americans can vote for this time so we can get rid of Trump and move forward. And they saw in Joe Biden someone who, A, had been allied with Barack Obama, and I think you can't underestimate the importance of this white Catholic guy from Scranton having Barack Obama's back, meaning something very important in the African-American community. But they also looked at Biden and said, yeah, this guy can get the votes that we all need in order to take the White House. And they've been with Biden. Older African-Americans have been with Biden from the very mm-hmm. beginning. Those polls didn't change. What changed at the end was a significant number of African Americans who were pondering other candidacies, including Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, said at the end, "Okay, Biden's the guy," and the rest flooded in again in South Carolina with a friendly push from Jim Clyburn.
The book is Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. E.J. Dionne Jr., New York Times bestselling author, Washington Post columnist, NPR, Georgetown professor, all of those things. E.J., thank you so much for spending so much time with us today on the podcast.
Well, I've always loved talking politics with you, and it was a lot of fun to be able to do it over an extended period. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. And we'll do this all over again.